Genesis 8. If we get through in time enough, I'm going to hope we'll have the time to allow for some questions. We resume our study in Genesis 8 and the account of the flood. Genesis 6, 7, and 8. One of the great values in studying the biblical account of the flood, we must remember that all Scripture is God-breathed and what? Profitable. God-breathed and profitable. We are all familiar with the phrase, all Scripture is God-breathed. It's been breathed out by God. But let's not forget, all Scripture is profitable. Why has God given to us the record of the flood in such great detail? One of the reasons is because our Lord in Matthew 25 reminds us of the fact that the coming of a Son of Man is like the days of Noah. We can expect a continuing world situation or a world situation that will gradually become like the days prior to the flood. It also shows to us that how severely God must deal with sin. Sin's awful consequences. When one considers all of the ramifications of a flood of universal magnitude, it is overwhelming when you consider this. This is the extent to which God had to go to punish sin. Sin mustn't be treated lightly. Now let's consider the details. As we look at Genesis, the 8th chapter, we have gotten Noah from prior to the flood in world conditions. We've gotten him into the ark, and now we're prepared to see him on the ark, and we're prepared to see the abatement of the waters as they begin to subside. You'll see that the flood has covered the entire earth. I mean the entire earth. It was not a local flood. Absolutely preposterous to think that God would have gone to the length, the detail of giving specifications on an ark of that magnitude and having him bring all two of every kind on the ark and staying on the ark for, or the flood lasting for 371 days, being on the ark approximately a year, and it be local in nature. Why couldn't God have just sent them all down somewhere else, sent them on a vacation, out of the area? Why these details? We have a universal flood. I gave you the reasons for that last week, so that's already in our file. We're ready now to consider verse 1, Genesis 8. But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark. Well, let's stop there. God remembered Noah. Now, if you know something of the character of God, you will know immediately that it isn't that God has suddenly forgot, as if he were looking at what was happening in the flood and the tremendous hydrologic action that was taking place, and then all of a sudden, oh, I forgot about Noah. I must come to his help. When it says that God remembered, two things are involved, and these are important to understand what was going on the ark in that year. One, it refers to activity, not the simple act of recalling somebody that may have been out of mind, out of sight, out of mind. Because of God's omniscience, Noah and his family in the ark were not out of God's mind. So it is a reference to the activity of God. This is used in other passages in the Old Testament. It is used of Samson. It is used of Hannah, when it says, and God remembered Hannah. And when he remembered Hannah, what happened? Special divine activity. She conceived in her womb, and she had the son that she prayed for, Samuel. So, when it says God remembered, it is referring not to a passive thing or to a response of God after a possible neglect. No, it's referring to a divine activity. And therefore, the second thing involved in this phrase is that it is a reference to supernatural protection and care. Supernatural protection and care for Noah, his family, the animals on the ark. So he is describing in this phrase the fact that God not only saw to it that the animals were brought to the ark, put on the ark, God brought them to Noah, but God also saw to it that they were provided for during that year on the ark. Their eating needs, the sanitation needs, the needs for order, all of this was provided for by God. So, God, Elohim, you'll note that these titles for God through the narrative are always significant. Elohim remembered. Why Elohim? Elohim, to recall, is the God who created the heavens and the earth. When it says, and God said it was Elohim. This is the all-powerful God who remembered Noah. So it's Elohim remembered Noah and all the beasts, all the cattle that were with him in the ark. And God caused, now there are three things that God will use now to cause the waters to abate. One, he caused a wind. The word wind here, the Hebrew, is ruach. The same word is translated spirit in Genesis 1. God caused, though, and it's translated here, wind. He caused great wave action by winds to stimulate intense evaporation of the waters. So now the winds. He caused a wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided. Secondly, also the fountains of the deep and the floodgates, thirdly, of the sky were closed, and the rain from the sky was restrained. So you recall these two active agents were part of what precipitated the flood. The great caverns of water just through intense pressures triggered by God's performance of a miracle, he triggered this, and there was this release of all these subterranean waters in the pre-flood world that fed these rivers. No rain in the pre-flood world. The earth was watered by mist. There was this vapor canopy that covered the earth, acted like a blanket and an insulation blanket. But now this vapor blanket has dissipated in the torrential downpour of the 40 days and 40 nights. And as a result of that, you have the polar caps being created because of the breakdown of the vapor canopy. Now we're going to see the change in climate. We're going to see the movement of the waters by these subterranean places caving in, collapsing. The river, the ocean basins will be depressed. The mountains are lifted up. There is a very fascinating description of this process in Psalm 104. Psalm 104, 6 through 9. Let's look over there for just a moment. And in this place, we have a description. First of all, in verse 5, we have an account of creation, and then it goes into description of the flood and its aftermath. Psalm 104, 5, he established the earth upon its foundation so that it will not totter forever and ever. Now in 6 through 9, we have a description of the flood. Thou didst cover it with the deep as with a garment. The waters were standing above the mountains. At thy rebuke, they fled. This cannot be describing creation because the mountains were not beneath the waters prior to the creation or to the creation of the continents. And at thy rebuke they fled, at the sound of thy thunder they hurried away. The mountains arose, the valleys sank down to the place which thou didst establish for them. Thou didst set a boundary that they may not pass over, that they may not return to cover the earth. This is, cannot be describing creation. For the waters did recover the earth in the time of the flood. This is a description of what God did in causing the waters to recede. Tremendous geologic activity was taking place. Why don't I just pause now to give you a three-statement summary of the phrases, he caused a wind to pass over the earth, wave and evaporation activity. He caused the fountains of the deep to stop. This meant volcanic action stopped and the eruptions of these subterranean caverns. And the rain from the sky was restrained. Now let me just give you a three-statement summary of this to try to get the picture before you. The first thing is, this is a description of the fifth and sixth areas of miraculous activity that occurred during the flood period. You know, there were six areas of miraculous activity. God only performs miracles when it's necessary. And there were six areas of miraculous activity associated with a flood. No more, no less. Let me give you those six, because we have five and six here. The first was the design of the ark, miraculous activity. God only performs a miracle. He does what man can't do. Secondly, the gathering and the care of the animals. This is the second area of miraculous activity. Thirdly, the uplift of the ocean waters from beneath. That is where the fountains of the deep broke open. God triggered the mechanism, and these great subterranean waters just came out and covered the continents. Four, the release of the waters from above. God triggered the dissipation of the vapor canopy around the earth. Now we have here the fifth and sixth areas of miraculous activity. And here they are. One, the first area, or the fifth area of miraculous activity, was the formation of our present ocean basins. The formation of our present ocean basins, described in Psalm 104, verse 8. This is where the fountains were stopped, and God depressed the oceans, and the waters began to run rapidly off of the continents, run down into these depressed areas in the ocean basins. The earth, the basins, the ocean basins were much more shallow before the flood than they are today, and the mountains were much lower in height than they are today. So the mountains went up, the continents came up, the basins were depressed, the water ran off of the continents, and the earth then took up the water that had flowed from been up beneath as well as had come down from the canopy. So the formation of our present ocean basins took place. Secondly, the formation of our present continents and mountain ranges. The formation of our present continents and mountain ranges. So we have, after the flood, these great mountains that were formed as God lifted them up. None of these high mountains existed before the flood. Perhaps none were more than 6,000 or 7,000 feet high. But now we have the great Himalayas, we have the great Rocky Mountains and the Andes. These were all brought up in the process. Secondly, the entire surface of the earth reflects the tremendous forces of a year-long flood in its abatement. The entire surface of the earth reflects, I'm talking about now, the entire surface of the earth reflects the tremendous forces of a year-long flood in its abatement. The abatement of the water. Now, I can only suggest some things. You'll have to take this and run with it yourself, depending on your own degree of interest, I guess. Personally, this fascinates me, and I find it an area that needs to be explored by many Christians. We need to explore it, if for nothing else, for the sake of our own children when they come back with the world's philosophy on the formation of the geographic features of our world. We Christians need to know what the biblical account is rather than the false assumptions, opinions of science. We need to know what the biblical record is. Well, we have such things as the following. We have the formation of the mountains, as already mentioned. The ocean, the great depths in the ocean. The formation of the continents. Tremendous lakes. You recall our viewing of the film on the flood? Some weeks back, the great lakes that formed over these continents. If you can just in your mind's eye imagine the continents being lifted up with all of this water still within their boundaries, and then the rapid flow of the water to the ocean basins and out. And at the time then, you are going to have these great deposits or areas where water. We have the great salt flats out in Utah, that part of our country, where you can see the remnants of these giant lakes. They've evaporated since. So you have the tremendous lakes existing, as well as rivers, mighty rivers that flowed. Rivers that were, of course, temporary in nature, because what they were doing is that as the waters were receding, they were running off with tremendous force and, as it were, scouring out the land. I'll give you in a moment an illustration of this in the Grand Canyon and its features. Sixthly, we have the formation then, or the beginning of the formation, of the great deserts. Seven, the formation of great canyons, the great erosion erosive features on our continent, like our Grand Canyon and others. Eight, fossilization. This, of course, occurred during the flood, not just at the end of the flood. It is occurring during this time, but it also is going on after the flood. This fossilization process, the formation of coal beds, oil reserves, natural gas, with this instantaneous compression of vegetation and animal matter with great tons of pressure in just a few minutes' time, creating these great coal beds and oil reserves. Nine, the order of the strata. Order of the strata. The sedimentation layers that were created during the flood year. As giant currents of water were moving with great velocity, would carry the debris with it. And the greater the velocity, of course, the greater the weight in the debris, carrying huge boulders. And one current of water would sweep over this area, and as this current of water will slow down, it gradually deposits its debris. And first to go out would be the heavier objects. Then next, the less dense objects, until finally you have the varying layers of strata created by these currents that are flowing over on top of one another with this great force. And so this is going on over the whole period of the year of the flood, and you get this stratification, the sedimentation process that you find so vividly demonstrated in a view of the Grand Canyon, and looking like, what would we say, a layer cake. And this is the process that was going on in the flood year. And even somewhat after the flood, of course, as the waters rapidly receded. And then we have also the formation of the polar caps, and then what we might call, in quotation marks, the Ice Age, not to the degree, I'm convinced personally, on my observation and reading of the material involved, that not to the degree that uniformitarianism describes an ice age, or four of them, but nevertheless, some kind of an ice age, as this rapid formation of the polar caps. You see, with this dissipation of the vapor canopy, we have the poles formed in their extremes, extreme cold temperatures. And we have then great bodies of water become locked in a frozen state, in great glaciers. And perhaps coming all the way down over top of Canada, taking the North American continent as an example, and over the, even down perhaps into the North America, how far we don't know. But yes, we can see some kind of we allow for an ice age or glacier activity. It's a very interesting study to look at how this glaciarization and this rapid formation of the coal or of the polar regions has trapped within it spectacular formations in terms of fossils. I think it's in March of 1972, a very interesting article in National Geographic on the tundra in Alaska. And you get these pictures of these all kinds of animals, the fossilization of these animals that existed in that part of the world at one time. And here they now are encased in ice. And they have been kept through the rapid freezing somewhat before and after of the flood, particularly after. So you get this process going on after the flood. So the crust of the planet, and this is what I'm saying, the crust of the planet Earth was completely reshaped as a consequence of the waters receding. And this takes me to a third point, which is really just an illustration of this, and to give you something to touch base on and pursue yourself, and it's this. An example, I want to give you briefly an example of the contrast between catastrophism and uniformitarianism. Now, don't worry about those words. Let's take the first one. You know what a catastrophe is. The flood was a catastrophe. And so, therefore, when we describe the shape of the earth's crust as being the result of catastrophism, we're saying that it was shaped by the enormous pressures and activity during and after the flood. Does the world system accept this? No, it doesn't. What is the world system's view on the formation of the earth's crust as we know it? It's described under the principle of the word uniformitarianism. And the idea is this. The processes that we see at work in nature now are used as a basis for explaining the geological phenomena we observe. Mountains, the Grand Canyon, riverbeds, you name it. Now, there is some truth to uniformitarianism. Is there such a thing as a uniformitarian principle today? Yes. And to this extent, Genesis 8:22. Yes, there is a limited uniformitarian principle. Because what God did at the time of the flood, after the flood, is set up the seasonal cycles. So the processes of erosion, by wind, by water, volcanic action, goes on. Or it picks up and goes on through our time. So you get earthquakes and adjustments in the earth's geography. So there is a limited uniformitarianism, but not like the evolutionary system teaches. Now, I want to contrast one part of our world, one part of our United States. I want to take that as a contrast between we who believe in catastrophism, how that contrasts with the way uniformitarianism looks at it. And I'm talking about the Grand Canyon. Anyone been to the Grand Canyon? Anybody? All right, two or three of you. The rest of us, we only know it by pictures. The Grand Canyon. What does uniformitarian geology say about the Grand Canyon? We were all taught this somewhere along the line, and we're just constantly bombarded by this. It's a part of the world's philosophy and viewpoint when it comes to geology. The National Geographic magazine has some tremendous interesting articles on the subject, but always, of course, from the uniformitarian presuppositions. And they have, I've forgotten the year, but a few years back, they had a very interesting article on the Grand Canyon. And have some very interesting drawings and showing you the layers, the sedimentation layers, and their view on this. Well, this is roughly how it goes, the uniformitarian principle. How did the Grand Canyon get that way? Now, just offhand, the Grand Canyon impresses us folks from the South as just being a real bad job of erosion, right? We've all seen red dirt washed away alongside a country road. I saw it on the way over tonight coming by. They've got all this dirt moved around over here by the airport getting ready for the new terminal. And we had all that rain a week ago. But what do you see? The demonstration of erosion, the action of water on dirt and moving it. So when one looks at the Grand Canyon, that's the first impression. This is quite a job of erosion. Well, we believe that, but not like uniformitarianism believes it. For uniformitarianism says that the Grand Canyon has been formed over hundreds of millions of years. There are essentially two phases. The first phase is when at one time you had what was called a geosyncline. A geosyncline is a vast plateau or a smooth area, and it's one great flat area, and in this area out west, part of which included what we know as the Grand Canyon, you had this river action that was bringing in sedimentation. And they had all these rivers bringing in the sediment and creating the layers, but also during this time, you had the rising and the sinking of that area, above sea level, below sea level, above and below. Now, we're talking about over millions of years, the layers formed by the rivers coming into the area, and then this layer action, but also the rising and falling. Now, we are to believe And let me tell you, it takes no small list of miracles to believe what they're telling us about these things. They're almost catastrophes themselves. And when they describe this action, we have this inexplicable rising and falling of the earth, and at the same time, we have the supposedly the Colorado River cutting through, this goes into phase two, the Colorado River then cuts in through this area, just like cutting down through a layer cake, and revealing all of this stratification that had been going on over millions and millions of years. Now, uniformitarianism does something very interesting. I call it circular reasoning. What they do is they look at the stratification, like in the Grand Canyon, and say, well, this was laid so many millions of years ago, this, this, and this, and the closer to the top, the closer to the present day, or more recent, we would say. And yet we're asked to believe that all this took place, and yet there was the perfect continuity of the horizontal layers all the way through this time. Never disturbed, with all this rising and falling and yet they all stayed in these nice layers. And we're asked to believe this. We're not told how, but we're told that it takes millions of years. Do you see why they say millions of years? You've got to have millions of years. Millions. You cannot give them enough time. They're always wanting more time. That's why they can throw about these hundreds of millions without blinking an eye. They have assumed the theory of evolution and then come to the stratification and then insert the millenniums, the millions of years upon it. I think it's circular reasoning. Well, what does catastrophism say about the Grand Canyon? We say that at the time of the flood, when God raised the continents, that the rapid flow of the water to the depressed ocean basins created the scouring effect in the softness of the earth, and the vast movement of water from, not the Colorado River, that is only what is left over from some post-flood gigantic river. It would have put any river we know of today, made it look like a piker, that this vast movement of water scoured the area out, and we have the remnants of it today in the Colorado River. Now, that's not only true in the Grand Canyon, but you can see in other parts of the world. But I simply want to bring that before you to show the difference, to put you in the direction of trying to, and for some it may mean that you're going to have to just go back and completely rethink your geography. Me personally, not only have I learned to rethink from what I was taught from the secularist, but also it just stimulates your interest to go and to see the enormous effects of the flood on this world. This was the hand of God. As he raised, I laid this map that National Geographic has out on the ocean floor, the Pacific Ocean floor. And it's, I love things like this. So I was sitting there eating a bowl of ice cream, so I just had it out on the floor and just look at it. And you can see how here's the depressed area, the ocean basins, and this varying depths. And you can just see the continents having been lifted up. And even the continental shelves around places like the Bering Straits around Alaska and around Australia. By the way, these ancient land bridges were the ways in which the migration of animals and man came over and moved out as Noah and his family embarked from the ark. And they went out, and as their children, their children's children, moved out through Asia, moved up to the Bering Straits, came down through Alaska, came down to this continent, and so on, down into South America, as well as activity moving, migrating into Australia. For this glacier activity, the Earth's river, or the Earth's oceans, were at one time much more shallow than they are now. And then, though, as these glaciers melted, and then these shelves begin to fill up with water, we now have the Bering Straits water. All three of Genesis, chapter 8. Let's come back. Verse 3. And the water receded steadily. The Hebrew is something more like going and returning. A tremendous amount of hydraulic action here with this water, even as the flood waters recede. This was no docile or a very tranquil situation. Rapid movement of the water. And at the end of 150 days, the water decreased. Now, on this chart, it's a combination of two things, really. The top line here shows you the sequence in days. The 7 days to enter the ark, the 40 days and nights that it rained, the 110 days the waters continued to rise to the 7th month and the 17th day. And then at that time, we get the waters beginning to decrease. The 74 days of 8, 5, the 40 days of 8, 6, and 7, the 7 days of 8, 8, this is where he releases the raven, and then doves 1, 2, and 3, and the 29 days of 8, 13, the 57 days of 8, 14. We get a total time period from the time that they entered the ark until they're off the ark, 371 days, 53 weeks, total time. Now, down below here, I've tried to show, here is the water line, here's the ark resting on the mountains of Ararat, and you see the water's beginning to decrease, and I've tried to indicate, might not show up, well, let's put it up like this. After 74 days, the tops of the mountains were seen in 8-5, and Noah doesn't know exactly where he is yet. He's the ark, and this certainly is a demonstration of the care of God in making sure that ark just rested just perfectly on the mountains of Ararat. Think of what would happen if it had been like that. How would you like to have had all those animals sliding up and down like a sliding board on the ark? God saw to it that ark settled and just rested right in the perfect place. The waters began to recede. You see the lines as indicated here, waiting another 40 days, and the waters move on down. Finally, it's safe for them to move off the ark. I'll leave that up as we go through this, and this will help us through the passage. The 7th month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark rested upon the mountains of Ararat. I want to ask and answer a question. I'm going to interview myself here in a minute. What about the ark? Some people are looking for it. Is it there? Can it be found? And if so, what? Well, let's come back to that in a minute. But the ark rested on the mountains of Ararat. And the water decreased steadily, going and decreasing, until the 10th month. And in the 10th month, and the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains became visible. Then it came about at the end of the 40 days, he opened the window of the ark, which he had made, and he sent out a raven. This raven is a scavenger bird, and it flew here and it flew there until the water was dried up from the earth. So apparently it didn't return. It was a scavenger there, so it would find carcasses. It didn't think anything about sitting on the slimy railings of the ark, and it didn't think anything about that kind of habitat. And so apparently it didn't come back, feeding on the carcasses, making to do until there was more land. Then he sent out a dove to see if the water was abated from the face of the land. But the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot. She returned him to the ark. Well, the water was on the surface of all the earth. Then he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark to himself. And he waited another 7 days. And he sent out the dove from the ark. The dove came to him toward evening. In her beak was a freshly picked olive leaf. So vegetation now is already beginning to sprout. Noah knew that the water was abated from the earth. But still, there was this tremendous wind action going on as the waters are receding and as the land is drying out. Now, that wind action, as well as the sun, and of course, storms are forming in some parts of the earth. All of the changes in climate are making their adjustments and are affecting the earth at this time. So in some areas, there is this rapid growth in vegetation. And this is what the dove brings back. And then verse 12, and he waited another 7 days, sent out the dove. She did not return. Not like the scavenger bird, the raven, but preferred a more suitable habitat. And this was the key. And it came about in the 601st year, the first month, and the first of the month, that the water was dried up from the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the surface of the ground was dried up. That behold there is indicating this is a significant fact, considering the entire earth was totally submerged. The second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dry. Then Elohim, the God of creation, the God who remembered Noah, spoke to Noah, saying, "Go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds, animals, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, and they shall breed abundantly on the earth. Be fruitful and multiply on the earth." Now, this is a different kind of earth, isn't it? We're quite familiar with the post-flood world. Now there is fear, the animals, man. There will be changes in climate, different vegetation, just a different setting altogether. He went out, his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, every bird, everything that moves on the earth went out by their families from the ark. Then Noah built an altar to Yahweh, to the Lord, and took of every clean animal and every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. Now that's significant. What was Noah's first act after the year of the deluge? An act of worship. An act of worship in response to the almighty hand of God in judgment. Now this act of worship is significant for a couple of reasons. One, it's an act expressing praise to God. This is what he's offering. He is offering to God this sacrifice, and it had to be a generous sacrifice. Think of it now. He's providing one clean animal. Of all the clean animals, what they were, we aren't told. We get Levitical designations, explanations later on. But this was a generous offering, sacrifice. It was one of thanksgiving. What was he thankful for? What would you have been thankful for? I've been thankful that I'm safe. And it's a little about like being up about 25,000 feet in a terrible storm with lightning crackling all around you, and you're hitting all kinds of turbulence, and then you get down to Mother Earth. He was thankful. So it was the natural act of worship to express thanksgiving to God. It was a prayer of praise. But it was also something else. This offering was propitiatory in nature. It was not only praise, it was propitiatory. This is what we mean. It was propitiatory in that it involved what? When you offer sacrifice, blood is shed. The animal's blood. Had they done anything wrong? No. And as a matter of fact, he may have become quite attached to them on that year in the ark. I think you and I probably would have. Don't you think that, how did he pass the time? I guess he walked by these little stalls and scratched them on the head and talked to them. Probably had names. And here he takes them, and blood has to be shed. You know what that's saying? Noah didn't understand all the implications, but I think he understood this. That in an act of prayer, I can only offer praise which is acceptable to God on the basis of shed blood. That's the only way. God was satisfied with it. The praise that goes to him is acceptable because of the shed blood of an innocent victim. What do we see there? With our standpoint in the plan of God, from our mountaintop, we look and see what? The work of Christ. And that's the only way that praise can be offered to God. Is the praise that's offered from our priesthood by identification with his sacrifice of his son. It says in the next verse that the Lord smelled the soothing aroma. Now you should know that that is an anthropomorphism. or rather we would call it an anthropopathism. An anthropomorphism is the idea of God having a nose. Does he have a nose? No. An anthropopathism is an activity of God, of man, ascribed to God, so that we can know something about God's reaction to it. What does it say? It smelled good. He accepted it. It was a satisfying, literally in the Hebrew, it means the smell that satisfies. God was satisfied because this was out of the proper motivation, and he accepted it. The Lord said to himself, and in response to Noah's praise, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. I will never. Go back to that phrase. Did you hear that one right? I read it right. Listen. For the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. I thought that's the reason he punished the world. Isn't it? That's what it says in 6 of Genesis. But look at it. I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. Look what he's saying there. On the one hand, he said, I've got to punish man because of his intense depravity and his extensive depravity. Here he's saying, I'm going to be patient with man because of his depravity. That's God in his immutable character. See, God never changes. It appears to man that he might. That's why the scriptures speak of God as repenting. But he doesn't really change. It appears that he does. Because of his integrity, God has to judge sin because of his righteousness. But because of his righteousness, also in relation to his love, from which patience flows, because of his love for his creatures, he is going to be patient and express forbearance with his sinful creatures. He knows what we are. I mean, we might can kid other people, but he knows exactly what I am deep down inside. He knows the deceitfulness of my heart. He knows what I'm capable of. He knows my thoughts. He knows that I am but dust, I'm frail, and he's patient with me. Don't ever forget that about God. Let's not be guilty of creating a false God, of a God who thunders about as some kind of a frustrated tyrant who wants to seek us out and stop us each time we step out of line. God is patient with us, patient more than we'll ever realize. So God, it's man's total depravity is the very reason for not repeating the punishment. I'll never again destroy a thing as I have done by water. Now verse 22, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, shall not cease. So the cycle of the seasons is set up. The temperate zones, the tropical zones, the polar caps and their activity. But you know what he's saying in this 21st verse and 22? It's this truth, that a million floods will never correct man's problem. What would God have to do if all his action was responding to man's depravity? It'd have to be a universal flood every few thousand years. We might be due for one right about now. But a million floods will never change the heart of man. That is why he sent his son. For his son will do for a man what a million floods will never do. And his son gives man a means of redemption. The only means of redemption. And the only way man can be changed. Now there is something that we need to notice in retrospect. And with this we'll go on off into some questions. What about the ark? Now, this may not interest you at all. Some of you may be. But since it is being, has become a part of a great deal of evangelical publications and articles and books, and we know of some who are trying to find the ark, and did you see the film on TV, a year ago, In Search of Noah's Ark? I mean, you saw that. All right, I'm speaking to a good number, know what's going on with the ark. Is it there? And has it been found? Have pieces been found? Let me respond to that in three ways. One, it did exist. It did exist. We're sure of that. I'm sure of that. It was a real object. And it says it rested on the mountains of Ararat. Mountains of Ararat, not mountain. And that's a mountain range. Now, some have felt and feel, and this is where they concentrate their search, on the mountain of Ararat. Up in the northeastern sector of Turkey, not far from the Russian border. It says the mountains of Ararat. But I know it's somewhere. I'm convinced that it's somewhere. I think probably it's deeply buried through landslides and whatever other kind of geologic action and wind action through the centuries. Parts of it are in whole. I don't know. Is it inconceivable that it could be, perhaps the majority of it could still be intact, covered somewhere? Quite possible. But I believe it. It did exist. And it probably is somewhere. I know of no reason why it would have completely vanished. A second response, though, its discovery must be kept in perspective. Its discovery must be kept in perspective. We have to understand the purpose and limitation of sign miracles. That's what the ark was, wasn't it? It would be a living, well, maybe we should say it this way. It would be a physical sign miracle right before our eyes. That's what it was. The dimensions, and think of the extraordinary value from the standpoint of a testimony to sign miracles. Now, I'm going to qualify that. But we must remember the limitations of sign miracles. What do you think if it were found? All of a sudden, we read in the paper, Noah's Ark discovered. And let's say the Turkish government lets us take it out. I can't see them doing it. They could realize a great tourist attraction. So they set up something up there in northeastern Turkey. And I can't see the Muslims at this time in history allowing something like that out of their part of the world for us infidels over here. And so they... So let's say we were somehow able to finagle it, and we were able to put vast sums of money in it, and we're going to get it brought over. It's brought over on this huge barge. They get it down to the Mediterranean and bring it across the Atlantic, and it comes in New York, and there it is for everybody to see. And then we get somebody who is an outstanding evangelist, and he stands right on top of that ark. And they get television cameras there, and we get a special on every night of the week. And he says, "Look at this ark!" And he gets Genesis, and he pounds the pulpit, and it's the days of Noah. And look, it is. You see it, and people just flock to the front, flock forward, believe. We see it. We see it. There it is, the evidence of the ark. How did people respond to the sign miracles that Christ performed? What does the world think of the sign miracles? Well, in his own day, people looked upon them with curiosity. Some people saw them for what they could get out of them, the bread line. The religious people they wrote them off. They saw a man who had been blind and now he could see. And what did they do? "You're crazy, mister. Who said you could be healed? Who did that?" You just write them off. It didn't impress anybody. Oh, a little bit, the marvel aspect of it. But did people come flocking? No. Because you see, a sign miracle is just like the revelation. It is the revelation of God. It's like Scripture in this sense. What's the factor that causes resistance? Human depravity. The very thing that brought the flood. Depravity. Resistance. Some might say, it's a fabrication. They built it, and now they're foisting it on us. We don't believe it. They would come up with some kind of response. So, would it be of any advantage in pre-evangelism? I don't think so. And then there's a third factor, and quickly we need to close on this one. The Scriptures are the only miracle object available to men today. And I believe God has designed it that way. This is why we do not have the real cross. Though that wasn't a, in itself wouldn't be a sign miracle if it could ever be proven. What, the Shroud of Turin? Some people really go after these things. Oh, this will do a lot, they might think, to get people to look. Oh, what the Ark could do if we could just get it on film. That would, no. Well, I'd like to see it, sure. But on the other hand, I have some reluctance. I have some questions. The Bible is the only miracle object today. Do we really need an ark? No, we don't. Think of the problems. Who's going to own it? What will they do with it? Will some cult get it? I mean, some cult come up with the money. Cults always seem to come up with extraordinary amounts of money. You get the money. Some cult gets it, and they build a religion around it. Will they charge for it to see it? You get all kinds of problems. Complete attention off the importance of the Scripture and the transformation of lives in as a testimony in a sin-darkened world. Well, if I sound just a little non-impressed by this search, or it's because I really don't think it's necessary. We have what we need, and perhaps we should ask that the motives be right. What does one expect to gain from its discovery, if God allowed man to discover it? Now, we've come to about four after the hour, and I don't want to draw this evening out unnecessarily long. If there are any questions, I don't guarantee I have the immediate answer. I can always run home and do the work between now and next week. But if there's any question that can be possibly answered or any question on this subject up to this point, ask it. We'll take a few minutes for questions before we dismiss. Any questions about the ark or the flood? Yes. Well, let's see my ark. I don't have a picture of it here. Apparently the construction of this upper light or the window recess in the top for light did not permit him to get up and out enough to really view the countryside. He would, perhaps the mountains would have, or the clouds moving in on the mountain area and the winds would have been prohibitive for him. Perhaps just the danger of it as well as the construction of the ark. And I get the impression the construction of the ark, it was not, just not adaptable to that kind of viewing, protect him from the winds and the rain during the flood year. Any other questions on this subject? John?
This ice age, the polarization right after the flood?
Yes.
I guess I'm interested in the time frame of that, because if it happened immediately after the flood, I don't see where those animals, where we had time to develop the animals.
All right, you're right. There wouldn't have been. They would have been animals that would have been caught. Their carcasses would have been suddenly caught and in water. And then the sudden flow of the freezing temperatures then would have immediately encased them in the ice. Those, and we've got a time period in the beginning of the flood when the enormous vapor canopy dissipated, and the movement of cold currents of air, and the formation of some ice at the top of the world, it immediately encased these animals at that time. And then after the waters receded, and then it became even more intensely cold, and the refrigeration process just added on to the already encased animals in that situation. It's an interesting area. I mentioned to you about the mammoths they found. Just walked in blocks of ice and food still in their stomach, and even one with the buttercup on its tongue. That's how quickly this came in. So as the fountains of the deep broke up, and the dissipation of the vapor canopy, all kinds of weather action that their habitat was immediately changed. I mean, that's what you notice when you look at this fossilization. You find graveyards of animals. And what is your first impression when you see that? You don't find them all neatly laid out. You don't have fossilization going on today like that. Where is it? You don't see the formation of coal beds today. And you find these vast areas of these fossil graveyards. And they're just all kinds of animals are just piled on top of one another. Well, currents of the flood just bringing them, dropping them. Fossilization. And catching these woolly mammoths up in the northern part of our world. Any other questions? The Genesis Flood by Whitcomb and Morris is probably the book on the subject at this point, and it deals with all the geologic ramifications of this, and we have it in our library if you would like to check it out, read up. It's a very good book on the subject, and others have been written of recent date. Any other questions? Let's close in prayer. Our Father, as our minds have been turned to your mighty hand, may this be brought right home to our heart in our immediate situation, that you at this moment are patient with us, though we have sin natures, yet, Lord, your love is not diminished toward us. You love us in spite of what we are. You love us because of Jesus Christ. And thank you for your patient hand with us. And may we identify and repudiate sin as we see its awful consequences. In Christ's name, amen.